Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Well, Joe, you can go there and David, you can go and Sue Gordon, if I can get up, and I'll sit on the floor. Look, it's great to have Sue Gordon here tonight. I'll introduce her briefly. Dr. Gordon's had a varied career, from time in the Australian Army to a law degree to her appointment as in the Western Australian Children's Court as a magistrate. But perhaps she's best known publicly for her work as chair of the inquiry into the response by government agencies to complaints of family violence and child abuse in Aboriginal communities, which was 2002. And of course, more recently, over the last year, as chair of the Northern Territory Emergency Response Task Force since the middle of 2007. And it's on that topic tonight that we've asked Dr. Gordon to address the Sydney Institute on the topic of the Northern Territory Emergency Response, a reflection.
I thank you, firstly, to Jared for asking me to come here tonight, and ladies and gentlemen, and of course, a special very family member, Jody Brew. I'll try and give you an overview of what's happened since 21 June last, when the former Prime Minister, the Honourable John Howard, and the former Minister for Families, Community Services and Indigenous Affairs, Mel Brough, announced the National Emergency Response to protect Aboriginal children in the Northern Territory. This was also then strongly supported by the then opposition. This bipartisan support for essential elements of the emergency response was, is, and will be critical for long-term success in tackling and overcoming the tragic problems in the Northern Territory remote Aboriginal communities. Of course, there's always going to be differences of emphasis and specific policies, but our legislators need to continue to seek the maximum common ground between them if they want to work effectively with Indigenous communities to remove what is a major blight on the nation's social fabric. Jared asked me to call this a reflection of the emergency response. I'd stress that this is purely personal reflection at this point of time. The response is not quite a year old, and I'm not speaking for the rest of the task force, which I chair, or the government. Minister Macklin last week announced the composition of a Northern Territory Emergency Response Review Board and an expert group to conduct an independent and transparent review of the emergency response to assess what is working, whether the measures are effective, and their impact to date on individuals and communities. In the announcement, Minister Macklin reaffirmed that the government is determined to improve the safety and well-being of children and families in remote Northern Territory communities and is committed to an evidence-based approach to closing the gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. The review should provide a wide range of evidence and opinion on which all interested Australians, and some of you fit that, can reflect, especially government, as it seeks to fine-tune the emergency response, whatever that means. I would like to frame my talk by referring to a publication released in October last year by the Australian Public Service Commission, which was entitled Tackling Wicked Problems, a Public Policy Perspective. It actually defines a wicked problem as an issue that is highly resistant to resolution. It's difficult to clearly define, has many interdependencies, is often multi-causal, not stable, socially complex, hardly ever sits conveniently within the responsibility of any one organisation, and involves changing behaviour. That's a very interesting report if people want to access it. The report goes on to say that Indigenous disadvantage is an ongoing, seemingly intractable issue, but it's clear that the motivation and behaviour of individuals and communities lies at the heart of successful approaches. It also says that a key ingredient is the need for coordination and an overarching strategy amongst the services and programs supported by the various levels of government and of course non-government organisations, and I agree with that. The term whole of government is used rather loosely, and I think people have to actually mean it. The report concludes about tackling wicked problems, how to go about that, and from that we can see that violence and an abuse in Indigenous communities is a so-called wicked problem. This is consistent with the generally held view that violence and abuse don't just happen. There are a multitude of contributory factors. It's socially complex, and there are systemic issues that mean it can be challenging to make changes, and sometimes things slip through the cracks. Much of the violence is a manifestation of social problems developed over decades. These include a loss of identity and culture, and the breakdown of Indigenous communities, unemployment, lack of education, substandard health, poor housing, pornography, gambling, alcohol and drug abuse. That's not all Aboriginal people. These are instrumental causes of dysfunction leading to violence and substance abuse, and frequently community members are trapped in this dysfunction, perpetuating the cycle of disadvantage and hopelessness. Often the violence is serious and often it goes unreported. In many remote communities, law and order has either been absent or seriously lacking for some time, which creates an environment where violence and abuse go undetected. It's not in my paper, but just very briefly, if you're living in a community of 2,000 people and there's no police, there's no streetlights, the police visit occasionally and violence is what's considered the norm, I don't know if many of you could manage. Communities in the Northern Territory have been asking and lobbying governments for police since 1990. They want them permanent, they don't want them just visiting. For Indigenous people, the term family violence rather than domestic violence may better reflect the often interconnecting and transgenerational experience of violence within these communities. There are no direct measures of Indigenous family violence, either between adult parents or upon children. However, there are a number of statistics that provide an indication of the level of violence experienced by Indigenous people. A particular aspect of family violence and dysfunction is very much on my radar. That's child protection. In my role as a children's court magistrate, for 20 years I've seen the impact on children and the long-term effects. As Gerard said, I chaired an inquiry in Western Australia, commonly known as the Gordon Inquiry, and the government of the day there, the Labor government, the former Premier Jeff Gallen, the next day said he was going to take on all the recommendations of the inquiry and he was going to act very quickly. And so I won't go into that, but suffice to say they're part of the things that are mentioned in the reference to the inquiry. One of the important things of that inquiry was we underlined the importance of a holistic response, one that extends beyond child protection and law enforcement agencies to encompass all government agencies, and one that deals with related community safety and sustainability issues. The other significant element of my involvement in what might be called the prehistory of the Northern Territory Emergency Response is the work of the National Indigenous Council, which was established by the former government in December 2004, and I chaired that. I've dealt with that as an appendice to the paper. If we look at the Northern Territory Emergency Response, the release of the Little Children of Sacred report was the catalyst that spurred the Australian government to act decisively to protect children and individuals at risk, and to lay the foundations for a safer and more secure future for Indigenous people in the Northern Territory. But it was also the culmination of the knowledge gained from several government reports in states across Australia on violence and child abuse in Indigenous communities, plus a lot of Aboriginal commentators who'd been speaking about this for decades. So on the 21st of June last year, the Australian government declared an emergency in the Northern Territory, taking the opportunity to act where it had powers under the Australian Constitution. The measures outlined on the 21st of June last, the government, and they included introducing widespread alcohol restrictions on Aboriginal land, welfare reforms to stem the flow of cash going to substance abuse, ensuring children's welfare was first, enforcing school attendance, introducing compulsory health checks, later changed to be voluntary, acquiring townships, to do infrastructure and housing, increasing policing levels in prescribed communities, which were 73, including requesting secondments from other jurisdictions to supplement the Northern Territory resources. improving housing and reforming community living arrangements, banning the possession of X-rated pornography, and introducing audits of all publicly funded computers to identify illegal material, scrapping the permit system for common areas, road corridors and airstrips for the prescribed communities, improving governance by appointing managers of all government business. Bipartisan support was given.
Thank you.
And, of course, you well know, those of you who followed the intervention, that the opposition now government had said that they would be relooking the permits. The role of the Northern Territory Emergency Response was to advise the government and oversee the implementation of the government's emergency response intervention measures. I agreed to chair, not really knowing what I was getting into, because my particular area is the protection of children. Across Australia, I think, that's not in my paper, but across Australia, I think that for decades now, the best interests of children has come last by governments of all persuasions. I deal with both criminal offences and the protection of children on a daily basis and still am appalled by the current climate that child protection is still not given the prominence I would expect. I came to the task force with that background, haven't been caught up in other issues, but have maintained my focus on changes that will enhance the protection of children. I speak to men and women on what constitutes child abuse and have found initially that most people thought it was sexual assault or rape. The original task force was Major General Dave Chalmers, Miriam Rose Bowman from Daly River, Dr. Bill Glasson, ophthalmologist, Roger Corbett, John Reeves, QC, who's now a federal court judge, Dr. Peter Shergold, and Paul Tyrrell, who headed up the Chief Minister of the Northern Territories office. The task force term of reference were fairly simplistic, and Minister Brough, the former minister, asked me to be full-time on the ground, which meant I've had to take a year's leave from my magistrate duties. The task force terms of reference were quite clear: provide expert advice on the implementation, provide oversight of the operational group, promote public understanding, alert government to current and emerging issues, and report to the Prime Minister and Minister for Family and Community Service Indigenous Affairs on the progress. Major General Dave Chalmers is the operational commander, and I think just a very brief background, a 30-year man, headed up the Army's work in East Timor, was the operations commander for the relief work after the tsunami in East Timor, holds two master's degrees, and so his background in strategic planning was vital for all of this. His role has really been the key to the success of the rollout. He and his team responsible for a multitude of tasks: community engagement, data gathering, delivery of services, setting up appointments of the government business managers. They're individuals who live in the communities and are responsible for all government business. And they also liaise with the Northern Territory government, and I do that myself. The public servants who've volunteered to work in the Northern Territory are people who've come from a variety of backgrounds, but decided that it was a way that they could make some change happen. And I've actually seen whole of government working, because public servants from all agencies are working together to achieve the ends. General Chalmers and I, as well as the Deputy Commander, Brian Stacey, we spend a significant amount of time visiting communities, talking to individuals, community leaders, organisations, councils, bureaucrats and ministers, and the other task force members do the same whenever they can. And I take the task force members to as many communities. So out of the 73, I think I've been to probably about 66 on all the town camps, some four or five times. So it's not just me, but there's a lot of visiting of communities. And sometimes I get a bit embarrassed because it seems like there's all this visiting, but people actually ask me to go back to talk about child abuse and pornography. And I suppose someone says I get all the good jobs. So each community is different, but there are common themes emerging: lack of policing, easy access to grogs, drug, poor and overcrowded housing, 20 to 30 people in a house, to name a few. Most of these issues have been discussed with governments of all persuasions for decades. Our community visits and consultations constantly reveal the need for the intervention to help and inform the advice that we formulate to government. As a task force, we discuss the issues raised and any perceived shortcomings we consider should be brought to government's attention. And I think this is one of the most complex and challenging whole-of-government policy interventions that's been attempted. It involves every possible stakeholder, from individuals through to government ministers, community organisations, academics and bureaucrats. As more communities are brought online with the various measures, the task of coordinating becomes more critical, as does the need for consistent communication. Communication is critical to anything, and initially we were a bit miffed, I suppose is probably a nice word, because Canberra was wanting to control the media, and the task force decided media was better placed to be done from the operations centre, firstly in Alice Springs and then Darwin, where we are now. And the minister agreed to that. And I think that's important because it at least allows us to localise what we're trying to impart to the community. So both Dave and I do a lot of radio talking and advertising to communities. In the early days of the intervention, we did see a lot of fear and confusion wrought through misinformation about the government's intention in the NT, for example. The army's going to take the children away. And there's still a lot of this misinformation. I mean, as recently as the 21st of May, Pat Dodson, after being named the recipient of the Sydney Peace Prize, was referred to as saying he wants Canberra to pull its military arm out of Aboriginal communities. He said it's a misuse of soldiers, move them out, get them to protect the borders. This was actually factually wrong. Yes, in the early stages, we used Norforce and reservists to help with logistics and transport for the operations centre, with the child health check teams, doctors and nurses, tent accommodation had to be arranged. And ironically, the Indigenous Norfolk soldiers and reservists who assisted in those early days were widely accepted by Aboriginal people. The Australian Defence Force, through its Army Aboriginal Community Assistance Program, has been operating in Northern Australia, remote Aboriginal communities, for years. This intervention that we're involved in is fundamentally about the 73 prescribed communities, the town camps, the children, the women and the abused and the disenfranchised. So it's an issue I keep coming back. This is about protecting children, and if you want to do that, you have to look after the whole community. It's not simply a case of just appointing more child protection officers, putting a few coppers here and there. It's about improving housing, ensuring kids attend school, banning alcohol to give people a respite, drugs, pornography, managing income for the vulnerable people. So they're all the sorts of things that have had to happen. I would actually argue that while there are many commentators saying mandatory health checks were a breach of human rights, I haven't actually heard any commentators point out that for decades before the emergency response, the human rights of Aboriginal people in the 73 prescribed communities and town camps were being regularly breached, along with the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child, which had effectively been abandoned. The neglect by governments of all persuasions of Aboriginal children in these communities over decades is a sad indictment for Australia, which is regularly described as a lucky country. The first phase of the intervention was law and order. And in response, making communities safe, and this was to go for 12 months. And so as of 4th of June, there are 51 additional police deployed, 33 interstate and 18 Northern Territory. There are now new police presences in an extra 18 communities. There were 36 before. Now, there's still communities who want police. Stores, there are a lot of stores in communities that were managed very well. Others were absolutely appalling. What the government wanted to do was to license stores so that they are able to participate in the requirements of income management, have a reasonable quality, quantity and range of groceries and consumer items, including healthy food and drink available and promoted at the store, and also, more importantly, can demonstrate sound financial structures, retail practices and governance. So every effort was made to ensure that stores are operated by people who can meet the standards. And the minister, once satisfied, will sign an instrument according to the legislation. As of the 4th of June, there were 57 community stores licensed, with 41 operating under store-specific licences and 16 stores operating under corporate licences issued to Outback Stores and Arm and Land Progress. We also have bush stores operating in some communities. A very quick aside, there was a particular roadhouse in the Northern Territory selling a kilo of sugar for $7. the bush orders are now getting it into that community, including transport, from some considerable distance away for less than three. And that just shows how Aboriginal people have been ripped off for a long time. Income management means that part of Centrelink payment is managed by Centrelink to help pay for items necessary for the well-being of a family. They deduct, after one-to-one interviews with each individual, money for food, clothes, rent, electricity, medicines, etc. The recipients still get their other 50% in cash. Now, that was asked for by women in communities who said they were sick of being humbugged. Now, humbug means, for those of you who don't know, means rest of your family asking you constantly, hassling you for your money, your cash. And the women are now saying they're very happy, they want to keep income management in place because it gives them a breathing space. School nutrition programs were designed to ensure children in the prescribed communities and town camps had access to breakfast, morning tea and lunch. Some very, very good Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory, don't get me wrong, this is not every Aboriginal community that's dysfunctional. Some of them have been running very successful school nutrition programs for some time. We built on that and put it in where it wasn't before. I recently visited a community south of Alice Springs. Bear in mind the desert cold is just starting and it drops below two. The kids there, they have either Weet-Bix or porridge for breakfast, a sausage and a bit of toast and a drink, a bit of fruit for morning tea and a sandwich or stew and rice for lunch. Now, the change in the kids' health is enormous, and the teachers are saying that. I spoke to the principal of the school and a couple of teachers. Kids are more alert as well. So as of the 4th of June, the 48 communities and associated outstations and 7 town camps where income management has commenced, school nutrition programs are in place. Government business managers, as I said, they are people from a wide range of backgrounds, police officers, existing public servants, former army officers, teachers and other occupations. They have volunteered, well, they're getting paid, they're not volunteered, but they've left their families to go out to the communities to work for initially 12 months, and it depends what the review throws up, and they will be helping Aboriginal communities where possible. One community on the Tiwis said to me, oh, we didn't like our government business manager idea to start with, but we really like her now, and she was standing there. And I think that was absolutely fantastic. Child health check teams, I've covered that. To date, the emergency response child health check teams with volunteer doctors and nurses have completed something close to 8,700 child health checks. Still going, the Aboriginal Medical Services and the Northern Territory Health are also doing child health checks. There was a surgery blitz in Alice Springs, and there's another 40 kids expected to receive ear, nose and throat specialist services in the near future. 256 kids have received treatment as part of oral health follow-up. Now, a lot of the health agencies, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, have said, look, we know about all those things. Why are you doing all this again? And the thing is that it's okay to know about these things, but knowing and doing something are two different things. Child Special Services, the Northern Territory Department of Health, funded by the Commonwealth, have now a mobile outreach service because Sexual Assault Referral Centre couldn't go into some places previously. The Community Development Employment Program, set up in the 70s, and I was working in the Pilbara in Western Australia when it was set up, was designed to help communities develop. But it became a nothing. Kids would leave school and go on to CDP. Now, you either worked or you didn't work. Some communities very effectively worked, but if you're on CDP and you're doing an Aboriginal health worker in an Aboriginal community, you just get CDP, which is work for the dole. If you're an Aboriginal health worker in Alice Springs, you get an award wage and superannuation. And that's why I don't like CDP. Those people are now being turned around. The Northern Territory Government and the Australian Government are now funding properly those people in their wages. The Australian Government, or proposed Australian Government jobs funded, are expected to increase from around 667 to 785, and the Northern Territory an extra 155. Now, they're jobs which CDP was paying before. Now, they're people who are getting an award, wage and superannuation, the same as any other Australian person. CDP, the current government, have said that it would review CDP, but it's now been offered back to those communities who want to resume it as of 1 July. But the new shire arrangements in the Northern Territory will see that a lot of that will go under the shires and they will handle it. We've had community employment brokers. There are 43 on the ground. Their job is to service, or they're servicing currently 67 communities and associated outstations. These are people who work with the job networks to identify more real jobs for Aboriginal people in communities. We'll never get everybody fully employed, but we'll go a long way. Work for the Dole program, there's about 44 activities in about 30 communities. There's been about 74. And they can range from erecting fences around rubbish tips or anything where people are getting some basic skills. Community cleanups, now that was one of Mel Brough's big ideas, was designed to make safe and do minor repairs involving the Indigenous Business Australia and contractors, tradesmen, electricians, plumbers, carpenters. So, and community people participate. What it means is that somebody goes through each house with the tenants, finds out what's needed to be done urgently, and then that's done. 66 of these community clean-up programs are around the territory. There's also, for those of you who are interested, a financial management program to support the implementation of income management. This program's an important part of the exit strategy after the 5 years, so that there will be community people who will get further education in money management, workshops providing budgeting support, and referral access to crisis support services. That sounds quite easy and quite nice, but if you live 300 kilometres from the nearest crisis support service, it's not really relevant to you. So there's got to be more capacity built into communities. Pornography and alcohol bans, they were also requested by women. And in conjunction with the Northern Territory government, liquor licensing bans are in place. Signage has been erected. There was a few problems with signage because people felt as if they were being targeted, when really it's only a small group of people who are the problem. Family support packages in the form of safe houses, which Aboriginal people and Aboriginal women, if I go back to 1979, there was a major Aboriginal women's conference in Adelaide, and they were asking for safe houses in 1979, and now some things are happening. Around Australia there are safe houses, but in the remote communities it wasn't an issue. Some have a safe house, but if you live in a very remote community in the middle of Australia, everybody knows that's the safe house. Mobile child protection teams and additional child protection workers. The government said that they would take 5-year leases on the townships, and that was designed to cut through red tape through the various stakeholders who might have a say. So work's underway with cadastral surveys to change the size of some of the leases, perhaps to widen some of the leases. And that's to do with the rolling out of the housing program, which is the second phase over 4 or 5 years. There will be housing going into about $800 million. And every one of the 73 communities and town camps will get something. 16 will get major works, and the rest will either get renovations or upgrades. The task force is talking to government about more, because that's the tip of the iceberg. If you live 20 to 30 people in a house and you're not going to get a new house until another 4 years, it's an urgent issue. The second phase was normalisation. And after the completion of the first 12 months, that was to have the infrastructure, as I said, amenities new and upgrading of housing to be done. The Aboriginal community-controlled housing organisations will cease to exist as of the 30th of June, and all housing, rental and maintenance collection will be the responsibility of the Northern Territory Government, and municipal services will be provided by the new super shires. So really, we're putting Aboriginal people back the same as any other rental arrangements across Australia. The third and final phase of the response was the exit strategy, townships being handed back to the communities and, of course, the government. I mentioned the review, which is headed up by Peter Yu of Broome in Western Australia. I'm not sure of the date they have to report, but it'll be towards the end of this year. The task force role, I end my role as chairperson on 30 June after a 12-month appointment. And as one of my mates said, you go back to the sheltered workshop called the Children's Court. And I expect Minister Macklin will announce the future of the task force, the operational commander and the operations centre in Darwin, what happens to them. Aboriginal people have asked me what happens because they're a bit sick and tired of seeing government programs in for 6 months, 12 months, and then everyone goes away. They actually want something to continue. The critics have been many and varied and are very vocal, and that's the right of every person. But they're getting less as the 12 months has rolled on. All the original measures proposed as part of the emergency response should be rolled out by early July. It was to be the end of June, but there were a few hiccups with a couple of the communities. There's always sorry business, there's funerals to attend, there are people who want to make a little bit of a stand because they don't want to be told. But generally, those people who've seen the measures and have got them, especially women, are well and truly speaking up. In conclusion, while I appreciate that a lot of people were opposed to the NT emergency response, either as a package or part, I'd urge you to read what the women and some men in communities are saying, how it's changed their lives. I haven't put it in the paper, but the Central Aboriginal Congress at Alice Springs is holding a men's summit for about 250 Aboriginal men from across the Territory and the Cape York area, and they will all have to go through every workshop, and then they will present on the 3rd of July to government and myself and Dave Chalmers their outcomes. Now, that's men taking control again of their own lives, but taking control in the way that they're saying violence is not right, violence and sexual abuse are not part of our culture. And so that's a very important thing to keep an eye out for, the 3rd of July. The human rights, as I said, and rights of children have been breached for decades by governments of all persuasions. But when you know the full facts, you'll understand why the emergency response was necessary. I know personally from my own experience working full-time on the ground the last 12 months and seeing the complete neglect of basic services and hearing the stories, talking to Aboriginal women who've been bashed repeatedly because of the drunken violence, who've been hospitalised, and looking at the stats of Aboriginal women who've died from massive injuries over a prolonged period. I'm glad this is a once-in-a-lifetime where major funding has gone into the NT to benefit Aboriginal people. There's still a long way to go, and the previous government and the current government, now the Northern Territory government, are all saying that they want to close the gap between Indigenous Australians and other Australians. It's okay to say it, but you actually have to do it. Thank you.
Many thanks, Sue Gordon. Can I just say thanks also to CAUSE for providing this fine facility this evening. So we come to questions and discussion, and we finish, of course, no later than 7 o'clock. Can I just ask you to for a comment on, you may not have read it yet, but Paul Toohey's quarterly essay, where, as I understand it, he referred to the previous minister, Mel Brock, as a thug. I think he thinks he's not too bad a thug, but a thug of some kind. How did you find working with Mel Brock?
Well, I have actually read his article. And in the National Indigenous Council, we used to call Mel No Nonsense Mel, because he called a spade a bloody spade. And a lot of his thuggish behaviour was because he was a bit tired of hearing excuses and seeing the violence. And I suppose the most famous one was at Wadair, where he confronted people and said, "I'm the man from Canberra and I control the bloody money." That's probably like your bank manager, isn't it?
Okay, we'll go there.
To what extent are these communities, is isolation one of the problems? And if it is, how can it be overcome?
Isolation is a major one, but in some cases, isolation is a major issue for Aboriginal people right across Australia. And in some ways, Aboriginal people have enjoyed the isolation. It's just that the modern day problems of alcohol and drugs are coming into Aboriginal communities. Transport is absolutely appalling in the Northern Territory. And I can't just say blame any particular government. But there's never been any major consideration to how people should be getting around from communities who are probably only 80 k's out of Katherine, for instance. There are bush bus services, but they're very expensive. But there's some work being done now to look at perhaps transport, because people from, say, Barunga and Beswick, 80 k's out of Katherine, can pay $250 one round trip to get a taxi to go in just to do their shopping. And that's appalling. So there's a whole lot of things that people really don't know, and these things are being brought to light, and hopefully some work will be done on them. They're not saying you're going to have a regular circular quay bus route or anything, but even twice a week is better than nothing, and it would benefit people who have a choice, who could shop in Katherine. They could still shop in their own community. There's more variety in there, and they may want to go and see family. And the cost of petrol today, I mean, I doubt if anyone in this room is going to be paying $250 for a taxi.
Question here, then go down.
Yes, do you think communities should survive if there is really no work? And the only way it can survive is on welfare. I mean, I sort of feel that just living on welfare forever and ever, amen, seems to be destructive.
Well, we'll probably have differing views on that. There are a lot of Aboriginal people who will remain on welfare. It may be a disability pension, it may be a carer's allowance, they might be in their 30s caring for elderly parents, and so they will remain on welfare. There's never going to be 100% employment. You just have to look at the group of people and parents that I deal with daily in the Perth Children's Court, that's just the white ones, who are on this cycle of generations of welfare. And they have to be gotten off it as well. So there will be communities who may get a lot of more employment. There'll be communities, there are already young people looking for other avenues of employment, be it mining companies. There's a lot of work in mining companies. But it goes back to what the system's allowed to happen in the territory, where you've got teenagers who can't read and write. Now, you can't get a job in a mining company if you can't read safety signs. And so there has to be a lot of work on work job readiness. And Minister Macklin is saying, as did the previous government, that the reforms to CDP will include adult education.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm coming back. As you were talking, I realised that I didn't actually know the number of people you're talking about. So I just wondered, what's the population of these 73 communities? And also,
oh, that's a really good question. I probably don't know the answer. Oh, yes, yes. I think the population in the territory is close up to 60,000 Aboriginal people. We were talking about up to 17,000 children, because that was the target group. Okay. Some communities, such as Galawinku, might be 2,500. Men and Greta are about 3,000, down to a community of 60 to 70.
Right, that's what they are, 60. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just wondering about the engagement of the community in the decision making and what structures are in place or not for that to occur. Because, I mean, you talked about what women are saying, but is there a more formal structure, and notwithstanding some of those might be quotas? So how do you engage with the community?
Good question, Jo. There was no consultation with communities. This was an emergency, so we went in without consultation. And as I said, and with respect to public servants, if public servants had to run this and consult with people, there might have been 10 meetings and then a review and then a report. But in the meantime, children are at risk. But what's been happening since is the government business managers and other agencies are now helping to build up the capacity of the people in the communities. Education is the key to all of this. The previous government set aside a lot of money for boarding schools. This government is adding on to that. And so there's a lot of discussions with families about getting their kids to boarding school so that they can get an education, and that is the key to the future. So that will build up the pool of people who in the future will be able to run communities, because a lot of those kids go back. There's also work being done in the communities to work with people who are identified as potential leaders, and the federal department, FACSIA, as they now call it, because it's got housing in there, They run Indigenous leadership programs right across Australia, and they're excellent programs. There's a lot of traditional people, young people, middle-aged people, who go to these and they live in, and it's really giving them the confidence to work in their community, but also to attend meetings, to understand what government people are saying. And so by building up that capacity, you will. But it's the shires, Jody, the new super shires across the territory, which will be employing a lot of those people who were in small Aboriginal organisations, because the bulk of the small Aboriginal corporations will cease to exist as of 30 June, and the shires will absorb those people. That's the theory.
We'll go right down the back, and then we've got plenty of time. Okay, yeah.
Is there any kind of tribal leadership in these communities that can be called upon to exercise some form of control or leadership within the communities themselves, or is it all done by formal structures?
Very much so. The bulk of the communities we deal with are traditional communities. And in Arnhem Land, you've got the well-known leader of Galaroi Yunupingu, who was anti the intervention and then has come on board. Galaroi's been doing a lot of work for people who have left communities and have gone into town to get drink, sit in the long grass in Darwin. And Galaroi, as a leader, has marshalled his community people up, and they now bring the people back and are accommodating them and trying to help them through alcohol abuse. There are leaders that in the Tiwi. I went across to with the Tiwi Land Council at their request to their new college, and they laid down the law, the whole of the Tiwi Land Council, traditional people, that only English is to be taught in the college. They're getting invitations or requests from around Australia for people who want their kids at that college. It's the early days to be taking others. But they want their kids to learn and understand English only. They say language and culture can be outside. Now, there's two school of thoughts in the territory. There are schools who want bilingual so that their kids are taught their own language in schools and they can go across. Bachelor College has two-way learning. So it's a difference of opinion by a lot of people. But there are very strong traditional leaders in the Northern Territory. A lot of them were disenfranchised by various agencies who come into communities. Just a quick example. Back in 1974-5, I was working in Roebourne in the Pilbara in Western Australia. As government agencies, we decided to have a desktop exercise and count the number of people who visited Roebourne Aboriginal people. Community of about 500 to 600 people at that time. We got to 71. Commonwealth public servants of a variety of agencies, state public service, local government, non-government organisations, religious groups and others. Now, this is still happening. And then they meet and they say, go back and write a report. They never give a copy of that report to the community. And they say, oh, they don't do anything. But they're at bloody meetings all day, every day of the week. And so people don't treat Aboriginal people in communities as mini businesses or mini communities. I'm saying to a lot of Aboriginal people, why don't you set aside 2 days for business for outside people? Why should they come here every day? It's an infringement. And the Aboriginal people are so nice, they don't say no. So Government Department A says, oh, well, look, I can't go Tuesday, I want to go Friday. Well, it's not their community. And so all those things have to change. If we're going to build the capacity up of people, they have to take control, and giving and encouraging the traditional leaders is really a way to go. And I think, as I pointed out with the men's group, that's traditional men taking control.
Dr. Gordon, thanks very much. I thought that was a fantastic presentation. The sense I have is that sustaining improvements in areas like health, housing and education over the longer period is very, very difficult without also bringing along the larger law and order issues and also the employment issues. That whole complex has to proceed together. I think the one thing that's concerned me a little
on reports concerning the intervention, and this goes across government, so I'm worried about the complexion of governments here, is the magnitude of resources likely to be committed in the long term to address those very broad issues of law and order and deployment. And what I have in mind here particularly is the demographic projections of, say, someone like a John Taylor, where there is very rapid population expansion here, and I don't see simply the conversion of CDP jobs doing the job.
There's not just conversion of CDP jobs. It's actually saying to government agencies, you want people to do the job, they should be just paid like any other public servant. So it's just not a matter of CDP. But as regards looking at the future of all of this, the former government looked at a wide front. This was to be done on a wide front, rather than just pick out housing, health, education and do a little bit here and there. It was to do it all as a broad approach to it. And yes, there's going to be a requirement for a lot of money. And interestingly, Aboriginal people and communities are much more aware of outside world than people give them credit for. At a couple of communities I've been to, they sat down and wanted to know why the Prime Minister was going off here, there and everywhere when we've got our own problems. And why are we spending all this money on overseas aid when we need it here? And then another group of women I spoke to last Thursday, we were talking about child abuse and they wanted a lot of information. And they asked me what was the latest on Fritz. And so we had a great laugh about Fritz in Austria, and I told him the latest news that 200 women had written to him to offer him love. Aboriginal people in communities watch the news, they read. It's only a few people who are illiterate. So really developing right across the board. And the Australian government is committed to helping the Northern Territory.
There's a question here. I've got plenty of time, so okay. It's got to be brief. Yep.
Do you have a sense of what's happening outside the Northern Territory and other parts of Australia? Is there a consistency there?
When we first started, Aboriginal people from Halls Creek and Fitzroy Crossing rang me up to ask when we were coming to Western Australia. And Aboriginal people from the Pilbara, where my people are from, asked me when are we coming there. There's just a few pockets here and there that need addressing. Last September, I pointed out at the request of the Kalumburu community in the Kimberley in Western Australia, to Minister Brough, that they really needed him to see firsthand what had happened there, because a third of the community had been arrested for child abuse. So we went across to Kalumburu and he could see firsthand, spoke to people, how distraught the community was, and so he put some assistance in there, a package, solid package for 2 years. Queensland, Noel Pearson, lawyer. Noel's Cape York... Cape York Institute has come up with a plan, and last year they were talking to the Prime Minister and the Minister, the former Prime Minister and Minister, about the plan. But they've been doing a lot of work up front. They've been talking to communities about income management and about violence and things like that. There's still a lot happening, but that's now in place because the federal government, previous federal government, said they're funded. So people are doing things.
We go down the back and we go over here. Yep.
So thank you. That was very insightful. Matt Jones, can you tell me what you think of the viability of some small remote communities where work is a problem? Do you think there is, what should be done about these various communities? And is that a reason why CDP should be brought back in some limited province?
What a reason, really, why? I mean, there are some very small communities and outstations who didn't form part of this intervention who would like to remain in traditional land, and that's where the much maligned National Indigenous Council in 2006 put to government that there had to be a change of how we dealt with Aboriginal land, and the Aboriginal Land Rights Act in the Territory was amended, and hence the pushing for 99-year leases, etc., because Aboriginal people are asset-rich and cash-poor. Now it seems like it's a really good idea. We got slammed up at the wall for that that paper in 2006. But if you look at it with a clear view, not a tunnel vision, you can see that there are vast tracts of Aboriginal Australia where economic development is a possibility. albeit individual family groups or big groups. Tourists love an Aboriginal experience. There are already, across Australia, a whole lot of Aboriginal people in their 30s, 40s, running multi-million dollar businesses. And they are the ones who are talking about alleviating poverty through economic development. And some of them were at that summit, I was in that group talking with them on economic development. And they see a way through all the mess. But small community groups, and even on the Tiwis, which is a large group, they know the value. They negotiated the first 99-year lease with Mel Brough, and they negotiated that lease for $10 million. Now, what they've got out of that is they've built their community secondary boarding school and all the bits that go with it. And they've got first-class people in there working there. So there are a lot of savvy people. The minister recently negotiated a 40 lease with an option of another 40 with the Groote Eylandt people. And there's a big resort there. So they're all stars. And economic development for the smaller communities is really a possibility. But it's up to individuals to be given the extra support, because there isn't anywhere you can just say, oh, I'll go to that place and I can find out about it. There's probably several agencies who deal with economic development, and that's where our government business managers come in. They can help bring those people into the community so people can start talking. And there are a lot of individual Aboriginal businesses in community.
There's a question down here.
Hi, great speech. Can you elaborate more on the police? You mentioned you don't have all the police in all of these 73 communities. Are they family people? Are they coming here to stay with their families, a wife, or...
Currently, the ones that have been in there before, the 36 other presences, yes, there's families. They're single at the moment because there was a real urgency to get people in on the ground. Eventually, and the Minister Macklin announced recently, which was from the previous government, I think it's an $18 million police complex on Gallowinku, where the families will be there. So they've continued what he started, and that will happen across. But the urgency to get police in was putting single people in to start with. The police commissioner in the territory is doing a really good job, but he also wants assurances that he's going to get ongoing funding to keep maintain the police facilities, maintain his police in those communities. He would obviously be nervous that things might stop. So the Commonwealth has to reassure their territory government that that funding will continue.
Robert Milliken. Some have argued that the remote communities in the Northern Territory and elsewhere are the result of sort of warm, fuzzy, Whitlam-era idealism, back to original traditional land, but that the communities have uniformly failed for all the reasons that you're dealing with, and therefore should be closed, and the people moved, I'm not sure where, but to urban or closer urban areas. What do you say to that argument?
Well, I would hate to even think that someone would want to try and move all the people. You're talking about a lot of people, and regardless of what you think, people going back to homelands or outstations, people are actually living on their country. People have a great affinity with their particular piece of country, and they'd rather die there than go back into Darwin. The problems that exist in communities are multiplied in Darwin. I live in a complex in Darwin, and 3 and 4 in the morning, debauchery and screaming by just the white ones from the nightclubs is just appalling. And the alcohol problems in the Northern Territory and drug problems amongst the non-Aboriginals is absolutely out of this planet. So I would never advocate moving the people. The Navajos, who I spent some time with in 1977, got moved. Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. Anyone who's read that book will know all of those stories about the Long March. You just could not move all those people. And you look at what happened at Maralinga, people got moved. People got moved out of the Great Sandy Desert, Percival Lakes area, because some English people were going to fire rockets, the Blue Streak, etc., all that period. People got moved and never went back to country. Now people are going back, and people are feeling whole again because they're back. Now, some communities might not survive, but I would never advocate moving.
Okay, we have here the final question down here.
Dr. Gordon, is it true that each of these independent Aboriginal communities have, say, you call him a tribal leader, for instance, he's the person that controls the ethos of what everyone wants to do, they've got to do what he says. This is the impression I've got just from the general media. That's the person that needs to be educated to go down a better path. Is that true and can it be done?
I don't think it's true. There are some very senior traditional lawmen who are very well educated. There are some very senior lawmen who take a bipartisan approach, who look at everything. There are other people who are often referred to as gatekeepers, but you could never paint any traditional leader with the same brush. They're all different people. There have been a few over the years who have perhaps wanted to control, but there are also other people in the community who want to control. There are white people in communities. When we first went around the Central Desert region, who were spreading fear and misinformation because they were frightened their jobs would go. So there's a variety, but you could never paint all traditional Aboriginal leaders as one thing or another. And under the law, for law business, of course, Aboriginal traditional people run that as they should. But they don't run the whole community. People have reached all sorts of agreements over the years, and they've become used to the white way of working because that's a necessity of life. But when it comes to law business, well, that's run by lawmen, and they do have a powerful say.
Final question up the back.
And women, yeah. And women, this lady down the front, so.
Hi, Dr. Gordon, I'm sure you know about the rising opportunity for analysis.
Just a bit. Well, Tom and I have agreed to disagree a lot, but I mentioned earlier that the human rights of Aboriginal people in these remote communities has been breached for decades. Australia became a signatory to the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child in 1990. So why are we still having, in this modern day, high rates of STDs, high youth suicide, and deaths? Because the human rights of these people and the rights of children are being breached. Now, everybody jumped on the bandwagon, and not just talking about Tom, and started to talk about breaching of human rights at the beginning of the intervention. No one's brought up decades of neglect by governments of all persuasions. And that's what I keep trying to emphasise. Okay, the Racial Discrimination Act was suspended, but that wasn't my doing, that was on a legal advice to the previous government. But in this instance, the human rights of Aboriginal people are still being breached. And until Aboriginal people can have the same services as any other Australian, then we're still behind the eight ball. I mean, people like myself from the stolen generation, some say I'm lucky, but you've got no idea what's behind me. The elephant's in the room there. And then there are all sorts of other Aboriginal people who are really at rock bottom because they've got no help, they don't know where to go to. And so we're all different, but we all understand what's been happening. Now, that's the starting point for me, is decades of neglect by governments of all persuasions. And I think we have to be realistic. We can't just say all of this just started on the 21st of June last year.
Dr. Gordon, many thanks. Take a seat. I know there were more questions, but it's 7 o'clock and Sue Gordon's taken many questions, so many thanks for that. I'll be very brief. It's pleasing that the Sydney Institute's had a bit to do with this current debate. John Howard spoke here last year. Jenny Macklin's going to come back and speak for us later this year. But for tonight, I thought that was a wonderful performance from Sue Gordon. I remember seeing her on ABC television last year, and as I recall, she was on a panel of five, but it seemed like 55, and everyone was against her. But she showed a great deal of courage, and I think, and a great deal of common sense. And if you spend a lot of time sitting on a magistrate's court in any Australian state, you're going to get a lot of wisdom if you've got a lot of, if you've got common sense yourself. And what we've seen here tonight was an extremely empirical reaction to a very practical and real problem. So congratulations on what you've done over the last year. I hope the task force ends up to your wishes, but congratulations for your past performance and for a fine speech here tonight. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.